This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Okay, let's continue. The language that Bergler is employing here, arrested development and this failure to see adulthood include maturity and the ways in which the language of the faith is changing, even to the point of redefining ethical behavior. All of this ought to bring back to mind our discussion earlier this week of moralistic therapeutic deism. The term that was coined by Christian Smith and his team of researchers in the book Soul Searching. And all these authors, Bergler and I think even Cosby, refer to Smith's work. This has become the lingua franca in describing the current state of teenage and even adult spirituality. Or at least early adult spirituality. And once again, how they define it. We have come to, with some confidence to believe that a significant part of Christianity in the United States is actually only tenuously Christian in any sense, and that it is seriously connected to actual historical Christian tradition, but has rather substantially morphed into Christian moralistic therapeutic deism. This is a parasite that has colonized the language of Christianity, and is really a substitute religion. Remember these guiding principles here that we saw of, as a Christian Smith puts moralistic therapeutic deism in terms of these five, if you will, creedal statements: that God exists, who created and orders the world and watches over life on earth. God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. The central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. The triumph of the self, again, the therapeutic self. God is not involved in my life except when I need God to resolve a problem. He is the cosmic butler, as Smith has coined it. Good people go to heaven when they die. And you remember how in that brief film clip we saw, how difficult it was for the teenagers who were surveyed to describe their faith in anything with any of the traditional vocabulary about faith: sin, guilt, grace, redemption, Christ's crucifixion, the gift of the Spirit, the Trinity. These terms are largely lacking in the vocabulary of teenagers, including those teenagers who have been throughout their childhood churched. One of the researchers associated with this project was a woman who went on to get a PhD at Princeton Seminary, where she now teaches, Kenda Creasy Dean. And her book is called Almost Christian: What the Faith of Our Teenagers is Telling the American Church. How many have read this book? Okay, this is the most frightening of the genre that I am surveying here. And she talks about how young people today don't speak Christianity. They speak Christianish. It's not a term she coined. She borrowed it from the novelist Anne Lamott, but it's very much like what's Stephen Colbert's term? Truthiness. Teenagers today speak Christianish. It's almost Christian. Now, what's particularly frightening about this thesis? She writes, she begins her book with these provocative words. American young people are theoretically fine with religious faith, but it doesn't concern them very much, and it's not durable enough to survive long after they graduate from high school. And one more thing, we're responsible. We've created this problem. Since the religious and spiritual choices of American teenagers echo with astonishing clarity the religious and spiritual choices of the adults who love them, lackadaisical faith is not young people's issue, it is ours. This inarticulateness, when it comes to expressing the faith, is not something, in short, that divides teenagers from their parents. They haven't been taught the language of faith because they've been nurtured by parents who love them, but themselves don't know this language of faith. The problem is not the youth minister. In fact, she poses a question, do we need youth ministry? Youth ministry is not the primary fault here. Most youth ministry is not accomplished by youth ministers. Neither young people nor youth ministry can be extracted from the church as a whole any more than the musculature of the body of Christ can be separated from the circulatory system. We have known for some time that youth groups do important things for teenagers, providing moral formation, learned competencies, and social and organizational ties. But they seem less effective as catalysts for consequential faith, which is far more likely to take root in the rich relational soil of families, congregations, mentor relationships, where young people can see what faithful lives look like and encounter people who love them, enacting a larger story of divine care and hope. That's a mouthful, and that's asking a lot. It's demanding a lot of the church. So let's just get these kids back into the church. Let's get them plugged in even more effectively in the church. And she says, no, you still missed the point here. Quoting from the team of researchers that produced the book Soul Searching, and she's among these that she describes here. We do not believe that teenage inarticularity about religious matters reflects any general teen incapacity to think and speak well, since many youth interviewed were impressively articulate about other subjects. Rather, the youth we interviewed were inarticulate in matters of faith because no one had taught them how to talk about their faith or provided opportunities to practice using a faith vocabulary. For a striking number of teenagers, our interviews seem to be the first time any adult asked them what they believed and why it mattered to them. Again, this is not because we made a bad hire with the youth guy. It's because the parents aren't equipped to do this. When people ask desperately, how do we keep our young people in the church? Professor Dean says, you're asking the wrong question. You're missing the point. The point is, how can we make the church matter? The church is an institution that is sanctioning this very inarticulate character of teenage spirituality. The church has become, she says, a very excellent communicator of a watered-down gospel. And let me listen to how she concludes in striking terms here. So here she says, this is the end of her introductory chapter. Here, she says, is a reckless claim. If churches practice moralistic therapeutic deism in the name of Christianity, then getting teenagers to come to church more often is not the solution. Conceivably, it could make things worse. A more faithful church is the solution to moralistic therapeutic deism. That's going to take more than hiring a youth minister, though that is an excellent place, maybe an excellent place to begin. What she is arguing here is that we have to reconceive the nature of church. And she says, in particular, we have to recover the church as an authoritative community. The church as an authoritative community. What does that look like? Here are some characteristics. It's a social institution that includes children and youth. It treats children as ends in themselves. It is warm and nurturing. It establishes clear limits and expectations. The core of its work is performed largely by non-specialists. It is multi-generational, something we've harped on throughout this week. It has a long-term focus. It reflects and transmits a shared understanding, rooted in a tradition, I might add, of what it means to be a good person. It encourages spiritual, religious development, we can say maturity. It is philosophically oriented to the equal dignity of all persons and to the principle of love of neighbor. It yields a communitarianism. I would add to this list, it would also be an authoritative community is necessarily a confessional community. She doesn't put this on her list, but she does make this clear throughout the book that a church is going to be a church like this, shares these ideals, if the church will claim a creed. And here she quotes theologian William Platcher. Even if I have a warm personal relationship with Jesus, I also need an account of what is so special about Jesus to understand why my relationship with him is so important. If I think about dedicating my life to following him, I need an idea of why he's worth following. Without such accounts and ideas, Christian feeling and Christian behavior start to fade to generalized warm fuzziness and social conventions, and it yields churchiness. Okay? So, it's important for children, for youth, to learn that Jesus Christ is our prophet, priest, and king, both in his estate of humiliation and exaltation. That Christ executes the office of a prophet in revealing to us by his word and spirit the will of God for our salvation. He executes the office of a priest by once offering up of himself a sacrifice to satisfy divine justice and reconcile us to God and make continuing intercession for us. He serves as our king by ruling and defending us, by restraining and conquering all of his and our enemies. This is doctrine, and this is life. This is why we have a relationship with Jesus. Professor Dean is asserting here is that doctrine is important if we're going to avoid churchiness. The difference between a Christian and an almost Christian is that doctrine rooted in the heart and yielding life. Now, what one thing you hear in all these, one more study I want to mention. I don't know where Christian Smith gets the time, but he followed his big book on soul searching with another book called Souls in Transition. And this was not studying teenagers. This was the religious and spiritual lives of emerging adults. Emerging adulthood is a sociological category that he identified as 18 to 29-year-olds. He actually broke that down into two groups, young emerging adults and older emerging adults. And this is a focus of young emerging adults, which means we probably have another big, thick book from Oxford University Press about to be published. And he describes the characteristics of this demographic. The growth in higher education has meant that many college graduates are encouraged to add more years of graduate school on top of their undergraduate experience. There's a delay in marriage that we see. Changes in the global economy mean a lot less certainty for a young adult at the start of a career. Frequent job changes, new training, this financial uncertainty adds to this characteristic of this demographic. And of course, on top of all this, the willingness of parents to extend support to children beyond the college years. So he looks at this, and there are actually some remarkably encouraging things to see in what he says about these emerging young adults. At least they're defying the stereotype that we may be tempted to place on them. Emerging adults, he says, are equally or perhaps even more religious than their baby boomer counterparts. Now, that doesn't sound like the sorts of things we're hearing from other demographic data, especially as we hear the emergence of this group called the nuns, right? The N-O-N-E-S, those of no religious affiliation. This is not simply a generational thing. In fact, it might be that this emerging generation is going to be sociologically more attached to the church than their boomer parents. There's also, he says, we see little evidence of the massive secularization among this group. But more significant, the authors of this book underscore the importance of two institutions that continue to endure in their faith-shaping effects. And these, as you might predict, I guess, are the family and the church. Remarkably, it seems, that they, here I quote, one of the most pervasive and powerful myths about children in America is disproven in their study, because parents remain hugely important for young adults, and their influence even trumps the influence of peers in their study. In the long run, here I quote, in the long run, who and what parents were and are for their children when it comes to religious faith and practice are much more likely to stick with them, even into emerging adulthood, than who and what their teenage friends were. And listen also to what they say about the church. This is an insight, I think, worth quoting at length. The empirical evidence tells us that it does in fact matter for the emerging adult religious outcomes whether or not youth have had non-parental adults in their religious congregations to whom they could turn for help and support. It matters whether or not teenagers have participated in adult-taught religious education classes such as Sunday school, adult engagement with, role modeling for, and formation of youth simply matters a great deal for how they turn out after they leave the teenage years. So stated negatively, when adults who have bought into the common myths and stereotypes as a result disengage from the life of teenagers who are on the road to emerging adulthood, these teenagers are forced to travel that road either alone or only with peers, and more likely than not, end up less religiously committed and practicing as emerging adults. Believe it or not, evidence to the contrary notwithstanding that we may hear from other cultural voices, the family still matters and the church still matters. Which, you know, leads us to conclude at least that youth ministry is going to be fixed when families are undergirded for the task ahead of them and when the church takes seriously its role of being the church. All these voices share in their urgent appeal that church, that spiritual formation in the church take on a multi-generational and intergenerational character. They speak with one voice on that subject. You see this over and over again in the literature. Sticky faith is the language that was coined by the Fuller Youth Institute at Fuller Theological Seminary. Fuller is often associated with pushing the envelope in all sorts of ways in American evangelicalism, not least in its views on youth ministry. But even here, there is a very strong sense from the resources that are available from the Fuller Youth Institute. I think it's stickyfaith.com or something like that. They talk about the importance of intergenerational relationships. As important as youth ministry is, the reality is that challenges of kids, ministry programs, and spiritual development are far too complicated to be met with a single solution. High school and college students who experience more intergenerational worship tend to have higher faith maturity. Don't segregate them. Don't assume that the youth ministry is their only, even their primary form of church involvement. Here are some insights that they go on. This is the Fuller Youth Institute. Listen to some of these. Involvement in all church worship during high school is more consistently linked with mature faith in both high school and college than any other form of church participation. The more students serve and build relationships with younger children, the more likely it is that their faith will stick. A couple more. High school seniors don't feel supported by adults in their congregations. By far the number one way that churches made the teens in our survey feel welcomed and valued was when adults in the congregation showed interest in them. It takes a church to form a Christian. Let me, I want to conclude this by making one more observation that I think this is no small part of the problem here when we consider youth work as something the session of the church is outsourcing. And a very, very helpful thing and an important thing that the church can do is to engage in a systematic plan of training youth leaders. Here's how a friend of mine, a minister in New Hampshire, has put together some suggestions here. What does training look like? First, of course, an understanding of the church, its doctrines and its ministry, especially through its confessional documents. Youth leaders should love the church and its worship and desire to pass this love on to the youth. Here's another suggestion. The nature and dangers of youth culture is something that obviously youth leaders need to be exposed to. Youth leaders should be alert to the ways in which our culture seeks to undermine a reformed concept of the church and human life. and seek to build awareness in our teens of the subtle expressions of worldliness in our age. How is it that you are being countercultural as a Christian today? Good stewardship of electronic media. Youth leaders should challenge youth to discover the ways that mass media and culture allure them to conform in ways that are contrary to godliness. They should teach responsible uses of electronic media, especially social and mobile media, developing media wisdom and navigation skills. We shouldn't overlook the fact that, and you who are in youth ministry know this better than I, there's this dangerous symbiotic relationship between electronic media and youth. This multi-billion dollar industry needs a youth market for its economic survival. And youth, for their part, are turning to the media for guidance and nurture because they're not finding it anywhere else. We need to offer a more excellent way. Finally, the distinction between biblical tolerance, which is loving communication of the truth, and secular tolerance, which is silence about one's religious convictions. This is something that if our youth leaders can't articulate this, we can't expect to develop and form our youth with these sensibilities. Now, Mark DeVries says one more thing along these lines that I think is important to add, and this fits in with his admonition to be slow, to be careful, to be deliberate about the work of youth ministry. This applies especially, he says, to the Youth Ministry Search Committee. The committee that hires must not hurry, must not settle. We've seen churches living in the aftermath of youth pastors whose hearts and motivation for ministry left years before they did. Another church decided that having no one in the youth director position would be better than having the current director. This is the problem of seeing youth ministry as a gamble. Let's roll the dice. How many here feel as though they were hired after a search that did due diligence? I don't want to suggest that the more careful process of screening and searching is creating the impression that this is a hyper-specialized field. Special. To make it, to emphasize youth ministry in terms of hyper-specialization is just to add to the problem of youth ministry. And it's to render this thing even more inaccessible to the parents and other laity in the church who ought to be owning it. But I'm always wary of anyone who describes ministry in terms of here's what you do for 2 to 5 years, and then you want to... That's turning a calling into a career. And the challenge I like to give to ministerial candidates, like all of you in this room, and this applies whether you feel a burden for youth or not, is that you should not take any call from here with your shiny diploma in hand if you're not prepared to make it your last call. Doesn't mean you're signing on for life, but it means you're making a commitment that you can at least conceive of being permanent. And part of the problem in youth ministry and in ministry is that we have distorted this calling into a career, and we've used... And what does that mean? That means in part that we're bringing in the baggage of American consumerism into our sense of vocation. The very term career is of relatively recent vintage. A calling, the professions used to be understood as callings, and the term calling, when you think about it, necessarily has a communitarian cast to it. We see our gifts, we understand, we want to employ our gifts for the flourishing of this community. Career has an individual agenda. I will serve here to the extent that it positions me into something bigger and better. And the goal is to find that promotion. This is something we really need to work hard to reorient our appetites about. We need to see all these things as callings. And I'm not saying these folks aren't, but I think that way of thinking leaves you vulnerable to making ministry a career.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.